Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Soleri audio seminar, Building Our Lifeboats, Surviving and Thriving in Risky Times. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm going to be talking about how we build our lifeboats with Franklin Sanders. Franklin Sanders lives 2 hours down the road from me on Route 54 at his Top of the World farm in Tennessee. With his wife, Susan, he's a successful precious metals dealer, a farmer, and an author. He and Susan have 7 beautiful children and even more grandchildren. If you want to know more about Franklin, sign up for his newsletter, or access his coin and savings plan, you can visit his website, The Money Changer, which is linked to the event resource page that comes with this audio seminar. After Katrina and the events in the Gulf in recent weeks, Franklin and I felt that many folks in our networks were grappling with a change in paradigm. It's dawning on us that we are on our own. We cannot look to government to help us. Indeed, government and government contractors may be harmful to our health. So we thought we would have a conversation about what Franklin and I have learned in the process of our lives and work in trying to move away from the old and build new worlds. We thought we'd have a conversation that might help you do the same. Each person and each family is unique. So is each place. Therefore, we are creating our own pathway, that unique formula that works well for each one of us. At the same time, it's always useful to see what is working for others who are traveling in the same direction. There is power in the community, businesses, and markets to be created from learning and collaborating together. We hope this audio seminar and the supporting links and recommended readings will bless you as we've been blessed. So, Franklin, welcome, and I thought maybe we could start with you saying a little bit about your experience grappling with the tapeworm.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm glad to be with you. What happened was that for years and years, beginning about 1968 or 9, I've been reading about the monetary and financial system in the United States and studying it, and I realized that we had a perfect legal and constitutional right to use gold and silver money, but for some reason we didn't, and you couldn't get it anywhere. I mean, not without, you know, not in the normal financial market channels. And so in 1984, I started a gold and silver bank, and I didn't realize at the time that I was running exactly contrary to the government's and the IRS's plans to create a computer dossier on everyone in the country so that they could track literally every single financial transaction that you make. And a gold and silver bank represented a leakage out of that system. So they came after me. About a year after that, on the 18th of June of 1985, as a matter of fact, and with the full court press, and their so-called investigation lasted from June of 1985 until we were arrested on January the 9th of 1990. What your listeners need to understand is that in the course of that investigation, the government softens up and then destroys its intended victim. Most people, by the time they get to the end of an investigation that lasts 2 to 5 years, have lost their business. Their business has been destroyed because, see, when these government agents pop up at your customer's place without any warning and want to know about all their financial dealings with you, and then the customer and the agent identifies himself as a criminal investigation agent of the Internal Revenue Service, it scares people to death. And so
Right. They
ruin your business that way first, so you don't have any way to make a living. And that creates all sorts of other tensions in your life. And usually, most people, by the time they get to the end of the investigation, will gladly plead guilty just to put an end to the nightmare. They have probably lost their family by that time. They've probably divorced. They've lost their business. Their whole life is in ruins. And that's literally the kind of pressure that you're under. And in some cases, they actually set up situations 2 times where I would be killed. In fact, they set up a situation where my wife and children could have been killed. And they were certainly conscious of that. So they didn't just investigate me. They jumped from me to the church I attended. And when the final indictment came down, there were 26 people indicted, of whom 17 held out all the way to the end. We were all arrested on the 9th of January of 1990. The trial phase, the pre-trial phase, went through February of 1991, in other words, 13 months. And then The trial lasted 4.5 months, and on July the 9th of 1991, we were all acquitted in federal court, the 18 people who had held out to the end. And then once that was over, then I was the only one who had to face additional state charges, because you see what the state and the federal government does is they double-team you to try and get to use the same set of events to get what amounts to charges on what I would consider double jeopardy. They charge you in two different jurisdictions with supposed crimes that arise out of the same set of circumstances. And, of course, you know, they have all the money in the world. We don't know exactly how much it cost just to put on our trial. We heard two different figures. One was a little over $900,000, and the other one was $1.9 million. I'm sure that in the period of time that they, in the 5 years that they investigated me, they must have spent between $5 and $20 million. They have all the resources in the world. Remember, they can print money out of thin air, but they're not exactly as free as you might think they are, because they have to get results. When we were all acquitted, the U.S. Attorney who had been pushing for this big, huge, you know, carnival type trial was relieved and transferred. So, you know,
that's what happened to us. Our the lead investigator, well, they transferred and rolled over a lot of them, but finally the lead one had to resign and leave the government.
And you know what your readers have to understand is that when you land in one of these situations, it lasts a long, long time. In my case, it lasted from June 18th of 1985 when they came in and announced I was under investigation. And they always like to catch you by surprise. They love to throw surprise parties, so you have to learn to keep your cool and not to answer when you shouldn't. But anyway, this lasted from 1985, June of 85, until November of 2000, when the U.S. Supreme Court finally turned down my appeal and my state conviction, because I was convicted on the state charges in May of 92, May the 18th, by the way, of 1992, and then went to jail twice after that, and appealed all that all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it was a very long, complicated.
It's hard for most people to understand, sort of from a morale standpoint, what it's like to be an honest, hardworking small business person, and to have the government and all their resources be free to engage in lying, stealing, criminal, you know, physical harassment. So you're dealing in a situation where they're criminals, you're clean as a whistle, you have to be impeccable in everything you do. They don't, and everyone around you tends to believe them. So it requires...
You know, this is one of the most maddening things is, although we have this system of jurisprudence that says that everyone is innocent until proven guilty, we actually operate socially on exactly the opposite principle. We actually, when somebody gets indicted, well, of course, where there's smoke, there's fire, right?
Right.
That's what everybody says. And so you get into this never-never land, and people leave you like lice leaving a dying dog. I mean, they just say, we run away from you in a wave, and you find out in a big hurry who your real friends are.
Right, you do.
And that's not as bad as it sounds, because the good thing is that the ones that are left are your friends.
Right.
They're your friends, as they say around here, walking or riding. And, you know, they're people who you know that you can put your life in their hands and they'll be faithful to you.
Right.
And so it hurts when you have this loss of reputation and loss of estimation in the eyes of all these people. But after not too long a time, you begin not to miss it, and you begin to be sort of glad that you're rid of all that dead weight.
You've decluttered your life.
Right, exactly.
Right.
You have a lot fewer phone calls to return.
Well, it's funny, though. I found a lot. I was lucky because my family was so supportive and continued to be supportive. But the other thing is I had lent or or donated or given about a couple $100,000 to people because I'd been very wealthy. But I always supported anybody needed my help, you know, I'd help them. And then when everything sort of, you know, when the tapeworm attacked, a lot of them stuck, and that was what kept me alive financially, was them sort of paying the money back, or get, you know, the people had seen me give it to somebody so they'd give it back. And it was about that amount of money that came back and kept me alive. But they subpoenaed my family and tried to persuade my family that I was a criminal. And my family just, you know, my family had a hard time connecting, you know, sort of the specifics of what was going on with their greater concern with government corruption. And, you know, I have a one side of my family are Quakers, and they're always railing against the military-industrial complex. But it's very hard for them to believe that the military-industrial complex was coming after us.
You know, one of the problems that I had dealing with these people, and it was the biggest eye-opener, it was the worst shock to my whole system of thinking of anything that happened to me, and that was that I consistently underestimated how evil they were. You know, I they won't go that far.
Right.
And, for instance, my wife, you know, we had seven children. At the time we were arrested, we had seven children, 15 or under. And I always thought that they would be gentlemen, you know, and they'd leave their wife out of this because, after all, she really didn't know anything about my business. Oh, no. They made her number two person in the conspiracy.
Right.
And she was facing 19 years in prison just like I was. And they set up a situation when they came out to arrest us where they wanted somebody to shoot back to give them the excuse to pour tons of bullets into our house.
Right.
I have no doubt of that, because there was no reason for them to come out with force. They came out with a SWAT team, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
I mean, they knew me better than I knew me after investigating me for 5 years, and they knew they could have picked up the phone and called, and I would have come downtown
right.
to be arrested. But
right.
instead, they wanted to generate the headline.
Right.
And, you know, that's part of that. All of that is part of the softening up exercise. They do that to soften you up, to demoralize you. And what happens is you sort of get into another world. Either you're softened up, demoralized, and destroyed, or else you learn to live in another dimension where the only thing that counts are people whose opinions really matter. You get to the point where you just completely ignore what the public and ignorant people say because they're ignorant and they,
right.
you know, they believe the propaganda.
Well, part of the reason it's hard is in my experience, most of the people who work in government are fundamentally decent.
Mm-hmm.
And we had wonderful experiences. I mean, we were really saved because there were so many government, honest government people who wouldn't go along.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it's almost, a friend of mine calls it the non-local demon. So you'll have this infrastructure of government people, and most are decent and hardworking. But then suddenly the evil guys will sort of punch through or come along, and then, whoa, you know, you're dealing with the most evil force in the world.
I never met any of the nice ones. They must have been working on your case because...
Well, part of it was, you know, I'd been a government official, and so I, you know, I had 7,000 people working for me, and most of them were absolutely wonderful. So I had deeper relationships and ties. The other thing was, we had an incredible church who really taught us spiritual warfare,
mm-hmm.
and we would approach dealing with everyone as though they were either, you know, a child of the light or someone that we were going to bring to the light. And so what would happen is what we discovered is most of these people had been told we were axe murderers, and then after we worked with them on the facts and the details of the stuff, they, you know, it took time, but then they'd suddenly realize, well, wait a minute, this is a bunch of bunk. We had one of the auditors who literally gave us an affidavit describing how she'd been run out of government because she refused to lie, you know, because they'd made several efforts to falsify evidence and frame us.
I think that points out something else, though, and that is that God raises up deliverers for you when you have no other help. didn't you notice that?
We had so many miracles that, you know, I just finally started, I realized, you know, there's something to this thing about believing in miracles because they just keep happening.
Right, and that's one of the things that you have to do to keep your morale up when you get into this situation, whether you're, you know, a hurricane victim who's been run out of your home or whatever, that you have to look for that relief that surely will come, and it does come.
Right.
You know, my son Zachariah recently had a tragic experience. His girlfriend's elder sister was killed in a car wreck, and she was She was a senior in high school. And he had been very faithful about staying over there with the whole family because he was a good friend of the whole family and trying to help them out and encourage them. And I saw him after a couple of days of this early in the morning, and I said, well, how are you doing? He said, well, I think I'm all right. He said, the only thing is, he said, you know, nothing really ever prepares you for a blow like this. And then he turned around and went in the bathroom, and I thought about that a minute. It sounded very profound at first, and then I thought, no, that's completely wrong. And I went and I looked at him, and I said, Zach, you've got it just backwards. Everything in your life has to prepare you for something like this. Because it's not just that every one of us will face death. Every one of us faces difficulty. And if you don't teach yourself a disciplined life and a life of hope and faith and a life of honesty, you can't start when the enemy attacks.
Right.
When the crisis comes, you can't begin then.
Right.
It's too late.
Right.
You don't have the habits.
Right.
I was very fortunate in that a good friend of mine, when I first started fighting with the tapeworm, very good friend of mine said, look, before you go into court, the one thing you have to make sure of is that you have a clean conscience. So if there's anybody that might have something against you, if there's anybody you have wronged, you had better get that straight before you ever go into court. Because the way the court is set up, the architecture, the layout of the courtroom is set up to engage your conscience by reminding you of the judgment day.
Right.
And think about it. You know, there's the judge sitting down there on the ground with you. He's up on a big platform, and all of the architecture is designed to inspire awe and fear in you. And my friend told me, he said, if you go in there and you've got something guilty, you've got a guilty conscience, you've got some load on your conscience, he said, it'll come out in everything you say and do.
Yep.
So that's one thing that you have to, you know, you have to start out with, is you have to clean up your act.
One of the things I'd had plenty of warning being a government official about what the how the tapeworm can act.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had run our entire operation to be clean as a whistle. And we did a lot of things with disclosure. And, you know, we'd serve all the cash, all the monthly cash flow circulated to all the employees. And, you know, I had a wonderful chief financial officer. It's just marvelous. And they had one smear in the paper about, you know, sort of implying that I had offshore accounts. And the CFO came to see me and he said, you know, I was wondering, well, maybe she does. And then I realized, it's impossible because I control and manage all the company money, and the person who works for me controls and manage all of her money, and she didn't write a check without me seeing it, so she can't have all her, you know. So we had been, you know, and so running it clean, and running it clean with honest people was a protection.
Well, sure, and there's another thing about that too is, you know, you don't have to remember as much.
I know.
If you tell lies, then you've got to remember what lies you've told.
Right, and it's much too complicated.
Than just trying to remember what happened.
Right.
You know, another thing is that, you know, we were talking about how your own guilty conscience will betray you when you go into court. Another thing that I found is that there's a fifth column in your mind.
You know,
during World War II, the Nazis used what they call a fifth column, which was they had a group of collaborators who worked underground while they were trying to undermine the government in a country getting ready to take over. And there's a fifth column in your mind, too. And the fifth column in your mind says that the tapeworm is really right and you're really wrong. How could you be right and they be wrong? How could so many people be right when you're wrong? And then, after all, if you keep on doing this, you're going to lose all the prizes that the tapeworm offers. You'll never be able to be in business again or even to make a living, and you certainly won't be able to be rich, and nobody will respect you. Everyone will despise you. And this fifth column, you know, these desires for recognition, for power, for wealth, all the things that...
We're addicted to tapeworm treats.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
I was sitting in my office in Washington in 1998, and I realized, you know, I'm banking at the same banks that are running HUD on such a corrupt basis. So so who, you know, somewhere behind here have to be present in this thing. Why am I supporting the people who are trying to destroy me and who are destroying the country? Why am I doing that? And that's when I realized, you know, I have to, I'll never forget the moment I talked to a friend and he said, you know, you're going to have to completely reinvent your life and your networks. And you know, but it was this idea of you're going to have to get the tapeworm out of your pocketbook. You're going to have to get the tapeworm out of your bank account. You're going to have to get the tapeworm out of your Rolodex. You're going to have to get the tapeworm out of your life. And but first and foremost, you're just going to have to get them out of your mind. And, you know, something, Franklin, that's much harder than I ever imagined because most people can't see the tapeworm clearly.
Well, it's not only that. It's also a matter that the tapeworm has been training you all your life.
Right.
The tapeworm was training you in public school when you were 6 years old, training you to get in line and not to talk back and not to question authority and to do everything that you were told. And then it would pat you on the back when you were a good little boy. And it's very hard to break out of that and to say, no, you know, the truth is the truth. And it doesn't matter what everybody in the world says, the truth is still the truth.
Right.
There was another thing, too, another way to prepare yourself that I found. You know, one of the ways that the agents of the tapeworm work on you, and one of the ways that crisis works on you, is that you see that there's something coming down on you, or you're in the middle of it, and you don't know what's going to happen. So there's this huge fear of the unknown. And I found that the best thing to do, I'd be worrying about that for days and days, and then I found that the best thing to do, the only thing to do, was to look it square in the face and say, all right, what is the worst thing that can happen here? What is the absolute worst thing that can happen? And then try to digest that and say, okay, well, if that happens, what will I do? How will I survive? How will I live? How will I feel? And if you do that, if you look at the worst possible thing as if it had already happened, then it takes away your fear.
Right, and then you're free to act.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can really rock and roll. If you have a plan for the worst case, then you can be much more, rather than spending your time and energy in being afraid, you can spend your time and energy in dealing with the situation effectively.
Well, exactly, and that's the worst part of fear is that it paralyzes you. You get depressed. And then you become paralyzed, and you can't act even to protect yourself. You're just listless. You can't do anything.
Right.
So there are times when you just literally have to make yourself get up and act, even if it's not an important thing, even if it's not something related to defending yourself. You must act. You must keep alive.
When we when the group from the FBI and HUD seized our offices in 1998, I mean they needed to. Essentially, it appears, destroy all the you know, sort of our databases and software tools. And this was the data that had the map of, you know, the HUD defaults and what would appear to be the HUD money laundering in South Central L.A. So anyway, it was very depressing because we had this beautiful office. It had won an award from the American Architecture Institute. You know, we'd taken impeccable care of it. So then you have all these people tromping around trying to falsify evidence, literally from what we could tell, you know, putting cigarette butts out on the floor and urinating on the floor. You know, they did everything they could to trash it. And so we made up a game. We said, okay, well, the firm's destroyed. All of our equity and our stock is worthless. But, you know, we still have the book and movie rights. But the fact is that the worse they are, the more the movie rights will be worth. So we started to play a game. And then I asked everybody, you know, because the question was, how do you keep your team working? So I said, okay, who do you want to play you in the movie? And a couple of people started fighting over who would get Meg Ryan to play them in the movie. And so the worse the feds were, every time they were really horrible, everybody started to get really happy because, oh, the movie rights went up. You know, and it was a game. But it was a game that had us going through, and we also had a plan for the worst case. So,
but you made a very good point. See, evil is not serious in a certain sense.
Right.
Evil wants you to take it seriously, so seriously that you're paralyzed. And the best thing you can do is to laugh at it. When we were in our trial, you know, the judge used to lecture all of us as if we were all 6-year-olds. One of the things that she was she was fond of saying was, "You people don't take this seriously." And inwardly, it was all I could do to keep from exploding with laughter because I didn't take it seriously. I mean, it's not serious.
Right.
Serious is the day I got married.
Right.
Serious is the day my children were born. Serious are those days. But this is not serious. This
right.
This is something that's going to be over. And the more you laugh at them, the harder it makes it. The harder it makes it for them. You know, evil is, in the end of it, evil is not noble or grand. Evil is not a picture of Satan in Paradise Lost standing on a rock with his cape blowing in the wind, shaking his noble fist at God. Evil is just silly.
Right, and it's small.
Oh, that's exactly right.
It's small. The, you know, part of the problem I think that people have in really understanding how the system really works is it's hard for them to fathom that anybody would want to be like that. So it's very hard. I find as I drive around America, it's very hard for my neighbors, my family, and friends to fathom, you know, the evil in Washington because they can't fathom why anybody would want to behave that way.
Well, for the prizes that the tapeworm offers, for
yeah.
for the retirement, for the McMansion that they can afford on that government, check that they get.
The one other thing I wanted to mention was how important it was for me to do things that my grandfather used to always quote Keats to me, and he'd say, "Truth is beauty, beauty truth. That's all you know in life, and all you need to know." And I used to think, "What's he hollering about?" What I discovered is you really need to build in time for things that are beautiful and for celebration and joy. You just need parts of your life and times where you just say, we're going to have a party, we're going to have fun, we're going to celebrate, we're going to, as soon as I got to Hickory Valley, I used to roam the sides of the roads and get wildflowers and fill my house up with flowers. Or I told you before, you know, when things were at its worst and we were completely destitute, I'd sneak out and buy a creme brulee, which of course I couldn't afford, but, you know, but it was essential to kind of have, you know, you have to revive that love of life, no matter what's going on.
And you have to have an alternation between fighting and rest, between
right.
work and leisure, which, by the way, is one of the, is in every circumstance, one of the problems with the tapeworm is that the tapeworm never gives you any rest.
Right.
I want you to work all the time.
And that's why the hardest thing I had to do was to stay healthy, because we had very serious physical harassment surveillance. You know, and then, you get 1,000 hours of work and there's nobody and no money to help you do it, and you've got to get it done. So, and in fact, I've posted on the event resource page the links and the description of all the different things I did that helped me sort of get through that. But one of the things I did was, you know, you have to leave traditional medicine and really get into what's the truth on nutrition and what's the truth on available technologies to stay healthy.
You know, one of the things that that people don't realize, they talk about stress and how stress is bad for you and so forth, and they don't realize that when you're attacked by stress, and believe me, when the fellas with the badges show up unexpectedly at the door and flash them into your face, you know, you're under stress.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is your adrenal glands pour adrenaline into your system, and if that's constant, if that's happening to you every day, day after day after day, pretty soon it just blows out your adrenal gland. I mean,
yeah.
Pretty soon you become shell-shocked. And so you have to be very, very careful that you know, to guard against that sort of thing. I mean, your morale is literally the most precious thing that you have to protect when you're fighting for your life. And you can't protect your morale if your health is bad.
I constantly would do research on who had been in a similar situation,
mm-hmm.
and what, you know, what had worked, what were the best practices, if you will, of being targeted by the tapeworm.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I discovered is that the thing that usually sort of killed people was their own anger and their own bitterness. And I said, whoa, you know, I've got to stay focused. Oh, and they'd also get into a mode where they were constantly asking everybody around them to listen to or reflect upon their situation, as opposed, you know, and I said, no, my situation is a symptom of a greater problem, and I'm not going to work on my situation. You know, I'll deal with my situation, but I'm going to engage with people on what the real problem is, which is, you know, why are we letting our world be run by a tape form? You know, how do we delete the tapeworm's power in a way that replaces it with something better? And it was that, it was being attracted to that vision was what kept me, really what kept me healthy.
Well, the other outcome is that you just sink down into self-pity, and the only thing you wanted to talk about is your own problems and difficulties, and so you become so lost in the details that you don't see how it fits into the rest of the world.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I'd like to, you're talking about taking care of your health and your morale. One of the things that I'd like to mention is that I did not do a good job of this. I understand a lot of this in retrospect. And, you know, I did a lot of things that were exactly contrary to what I should have done. And that, I think the best piece of advice you can give anybody who lands in a crisis or who's attacked by the tapeworm is that they ought to stop and be self-conscious about what they do. They ought to think, why am I undergoing this? What does all this mean? Not just for me, but for the people that I face. Because you'll do a lot better if you know where you're going and you're not just reacting. As long as the enemy can make you react, remember, he controls you. You don't control him.
Right.
And as long as he keeps you in fear and has you reacting to his initiatives, he has you. You said something just a moment ago that I think bears expanding on. The people who are attacking you, even the very agents who are the worst, the best thing that you can do is focus on asking God to forgive them.
Right.
Because if you don't, then the bitterness and the desire for revenge just overcomes you.
Right.
And you spend all your time in these daydreams about tearing them apart limb by limb and that sort of thing. And it does is bury you under a flood of evil emotions.
Well, the other thing, though, is it also just strategically it focuses you on the lower level people as opposed to getting to the bottom of who's really in charge and who's really pulling the strings. Because generally in situations like that, it's no one in government who's pulling the strings. In other words, there is no government. In my experience, there is no government. There's a series of private parties who make all the decisions and pull the strings. And you can't figure out who that is and what's going on if you're just so mad at the guy who's in your face.
Right.
So it's funny because I used to, you know, I looked at the funny thing is all my life I'd wanted to understand how the money really worked. And where I was stuck was I really couldn't get, I really didn't understand the covert side of the house. And if it wasn't for the tapeworm attacking me, I'd never be able to, you know, that's how I got the knowledge that I'd always, you know, I'd always asked for. So the next time I ask for it, I'm going to ask for it. Could it come in a more comfortable form? You know, it pays to look deeper in your situation and say, why is this happening? You know, I dare say what happened to you, you know, from what I've seen and what I expect over time, you're going to be able to help thousands, if not millions of people because of what you learned in that experience.
Right, but that's, see, again, that's why I say to your listeners that they need to be extremely self-conscious about their lives.
Right.
They need to examine their situation and where they are, especially. It's important every day because you're preparing for crisis every day that you live by learning to discipline yourself and to do the right thing. But it's especially important when you really land into that crisis that you take that 1 minute to get your bearings and look around and say, who am I, what am I doing, and what are really the issues here?
But I took the position that I had a guy work for me in government who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new.
Yes.
And what he meant by that is we're going to invent the new world in how we clean up the mess. And so, you know, it's not like you invent a new perfect world over here on the, you know, you got to invent it out of, just like the lotus blossom comes out of the mud, you got to invent it in dealing with the worst part of what's in your face day to day. So that's, you know, I was always trying to persuade the different people and attorneys and lawyers, you know, let me tell you about the Solari model. Let me tell you why we need this. Well, let's talk about going local, because you know, my take on all of this, Franklin, as you know, is the tapeworm is financing itself one family in one neighborhood at a time, and the key to changing that is if we can switch our time, our attention, our resources, and cut the tapeworm. You know, if we can all just cut the tapeworm off in our neighborhood, what a difference it could make.
I listen to or I hear a lot of people who are worried about the so-called New World Order and globalization, and it goes on and on, that whole complex of things, and they get all excited about it, you know, and they're all, we got to stop this, and we got to do this, and we got to write our congressman, and so forth and so on. And I just breathe a huge sigh, because that, all of that is stupid. It's the tapeworm sucking you away to diffuse and spend your energy in something that is completely valueless.
Right.
Instead of spending your energy in building that new world that you're talking about. And,
right.
And the only place I can do that is in my own locality. You know, they can talk about the New World Order all they want, but the fact is, if the New World Order stops at the boundary of my county, it's not a problem for me. It's just not a problem. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not concerned about other people in other places, but I am saying that there's a kind of telescopic philanthropy that is really the avoidance of philanthropy.
Right.
In other words, you're always worried about the poor people in India, but
right.
You never look at the poor people in Lawrence County or Wayne County or wherever you live.
Right.
So that's our proper focus, because I can't do anything about the whole world. I can't do anything about Bush. I can't do anything about, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats or the big machine, but I can sure do something about my neighbors. And first of all, I can do something in my own family.
Well, but if everybody takes that position and networks, then in fact you can do something about Bush.
Well, exactly.
Because you've got, I mean, it was so sad to see everybody run off and spend a huge amount of time on the presidential election in 2004, while the tapeworm just finished consolidating control of the machinery one county at a time.
Right. You know, there's an example of this that I can give you that exactly shows what I mean. On the one hand is the picture of the way things used to work in the South around the Mississippi River. When there was a hurricane that came to New Orleans or there was a flood, what traditionally happened was everybody in the locale, all the men and the women too, came out and they filled sandbags and they put sandbags on the levee. They did whatever they had to do to protect their community. Now, in the recent Hurricane Katrina events, local people were forbidden to volunteer, forbidden to help, and everything was professionalized. You know, we're the government, we're going to take care of everything. We're FEMA. And so you get this picture of an enormous hole in the levee and a helicopter dropping a 3,000-pound sandbag in that hole, trying to stop up the hole. Instead of
nuts.
I know it's nuts. It's completely crazy. But those two contrasting pictures really show the difference between trying to fix the whole big problem and trying to fix it locally. I mean, it's just so much, there's so much more you can do locally than you can nationally or internationally.
Well, the other thing is, if you don't do it locally, then the governmental agenda that will control if it wants to in your area is relates to a highly centralized, what is in the best interest of a highly centralized, very small group of people, and you could be very much at the short end of the stick. So
you will be at the short end of the stick.
Right.
I mean, does anybody think that the Democrats or Republicans really have at heart the interests of Joe Blow and Jane Doe, who go out and go door to door passing out their campaign literature?
Well, but here's the hub, the core of the challenge before us, I think, Franklin, is most people can see the tapeworm when it's far away, but they can't see it up close. They can't see it in their own neighborhood. They can't see it, you know, because they tend to think of the tapeworm as sort of what thing. So, you know, 4 trillion missing or peak oil, or as opposed to who's really doing, who is the tapeworm? Who's doing this? Who's accountable? And so, you know, I've on recent travels, you know, I've found people who say that the solution is to get Bush out and to get Hillary Clinton elected president, and they really believe that that's going to make a difference. So
people like that have fallen for the trap of the tapeworm.
Right.
And what they've done is they've believed the lie from the tapeworm so that the tapeworm has effectively neutralized them.
Right.
It has convinced them to waste their efforts in a pointless exercise, and therefore they can't spend their efforts doing something that really might work against the tapeworm.
Right, and part of it is they really do not understand how the money and power works locally in their county and their state. They don't understand, we don't understand our municipal services, we don't understand the economics of all the government money around us, and until we do, I don't see how you really start to get traction to turn things around. But that comes back to focusing on your local neighborhood, because that's where the action is.
You mean, when you say how the money works, you mean how many people are dependent on it, or?
What it's doing, what the incentive systems are, who's got it, who's making money, who's losing money, and to do what, and for why. So, for example, the example I always use is the, you know, neighborhoods I found where we were spending $250,000 per unit to build public housing, when $50,000 would buy and rehab a single-family home.
Right.
So you know, why are you doing that? And, you know, to me, when you have a system where the average American is, say, they're making $35,000, $45,000 a year and paying $5,000 in taxes, to watch it just thrown away like that creates not only a terrible economic precedent, but a terrible moral precedent. So, but if we're all walking around blind to that, and you can't clean that up in the nation, you can only clean that up and deal with that in your neighborhood.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems is that the people who become dependent on the tapeworm don't realize that how much worse off the prizes that the tapeworm offers them really makes their lives. You know, it's like kids being fed white sugar candy.
Right.
They think that the white sugar candy is a treat that they want, and they don't realize how bad the white sugar candy is really going to make their lives.
Right.
You know, it's that way with farmers. I have a very good friend here who's become a good friend here. He's a local fellow, and he worked in a factory from the time that he got out of high school. The Monday after he got out of high school, he went to work in a factory. And although he's raised on a farm, and he'd had a job all his life, and then at age 28, the CEO of the company really stuck a knife in his back, and so he quit. He had a couple of jobs, and he's got a big farm, like 150 acres. He had some cattle, and he raises bees, and he can do anything in the world. And I kept saying to him, "Man, why do you want a job? You know, that's the last thing you need." And you know, he'd talk about, well, there's this government loan and that government loan available, and there are a huge number of them, of loans and grants and all this kind of stuff. Well, they're not really grants, but different loans and programs for farmers. And in fact, most farmers live off of those.
Okay.
And they don't realize, and I keep trying to tell my friend, every time you get money from the government, from the tapeworm, it comes with a sock in the jaw.
Right.
There's no other way. And the only way you can avoid the sock in the jaw is not to take the bait.
Right. We had one contract in my last company where we had a joint venture with a government agency, and they paid about half, and we paid about half. And we opted not to renew there was a third year, and we declined to renew it because what we discovered was it was cheaper to pay 100% than to have to deal with them for 50%. So 50%, their money cost more, and that's what a negative return on investment is. Their money costs more. Their dollar costs you $1.50. The other thing I found is that if you just make a decision, no, I'm not, you know, I'm going to get this fifth column out of my head. I'm not going to do business with the tapeworm. I'm not going to do business with their banks. I'm going to work hard to avoid their, you know, buying at their stores. I'm going to try not to invest in them. I'm not going to pay attention. You know, I'm going to cut off the media. Because one of the big things, you know, I have is turn off your TV and get rid of corporate media. But what I found is the more I made an effort to get to know people who were living and, you know, not focused on the tapeworm, the the more I networked and filled my life with people and companies who were sort of tapeworm removed, something very magical started to happen. And that is, you know, things went faster, you learned more, there was less stress. You know, something wonderful happened if you when you just started to pull away.
But, you know, I have to say that all of my experience that I went through for 15 years fighting with the government was worth it. Every bit of that was worth it because it freed me from so many things.
Right.
It put me outside of that tapeworm system. I have to go back to what you said about TV because my daughter, Liberty, has a great saying about that. TV is the prime carrier of greed. She said, when my kids go and stay with their grandparents, not this grandparent, but their other grandparents, and they watch TV, she said, then they come back and they say, I want this and I want that. And they got it off the TV.
Right.
So
right.
You're right. The TV is a you know, one of those prime agents of the fifth column in your mind.
I was in the 80s on Wall Street, I was privy to, I overheard a conversation about some of the subliminal programming and entrainment techniques that were going to start to be used on TV. And I'm not a scared person. I came home and that was it. I turned off my TV and then I got divorced 2 years later and I've never had a TV. Somebody bought a TV for me when I worked in the government, said you can't work in the government and not have a TV. And as soon as I left, you know, out went that TV. So I'm scared to death to even have them in my house because I just think it's, you know, you have no idea what you're inviting into your mind when you engage in that stuff.
Well, it's one of those elements that keeps you unconscious and keeps you from examining your own life.
Right. Well, and that, you know, the learning. I've spent now since 1998 trying to learn all this stuff. When I come over to your place, I'm always amazed at how much you guys are learning at high speed about how to raise, you know, hogs and how to take care of horses. And you know, there's a huge amount of learning that comes with learning about your local area and self-sufficiency. And that takes time. And so if you know, the average American spends something like 20 hours a week watching TV. Imagine if we were spending that time watching, you know, learning the skills that we need.
If you spent that time learning your neighbors.
Right.
Imagine if you spent that time talking to your neighbors and getting to know them.
Right.
Imagine how much stronger bond of community you'd have with them if you did that. You know, we started this thing here called a teacherless writing class. You know, it sounds like it wouldn't possibly work, but it does. We have one of our friends is a very accomplished poetess, and she suggested that we have a teacherless writing class. And what that is we get together, there may be 12 or 15 of us, and everybody reads something that he has written himself. And the only rule is that you can't say anything before you read. You can't say anything like, well, this is not really any good, or I'm not really finished with this. Or, you can't say anything self-deprecatory. You have to just read it. And then everybody criticizes it. And it has been incredible what we have learned about each other. Even, you know, members of my own family, it's amazing how much you can see into someone else's soul through what they write.
Right.
And if we sat and watched TV, we'd never experienced that.
Right.
We would never have known that.
Right. Well, another one of my bugaboos is eating fresh food.
Mm-hmm.
And since you're a farmer, it seems to me that you should more fairly address this than me.
Well, you know, of course, it's hard. If you live in a city, it's often hard to find fresh food.
Yes, it is. And affordable fresh food is
right,
hard.
Right, exactly. But you generally, if you dig enough, you'll find that fresh food. And one of the exciting things about it is that when you find the fresh food, you'll also meet other people who are interested in the fresh food.
Right.
Which means that you're going to meet more of the same kind of people that you want to meet. But even if you can't get, even if you can't find some farmer who can help you, you can grow your own. It's the best garden Susan and I ever raised. We raised in Midtown Memphis on a standard size lot in the older part of town, and we raised it in our flower beds.
Oh, my word.
Believe it or not. In fact, we planted, all along one side of the yard, we planted sweet potatoes.
Uh-huh.
And all summer long, people would slam on the brakes, get out of their car, and come up to the front door and ask us what that beautiful ornamental plant was that we planted in the front yard. And the great thing about it was we got to eat them at the end of the season.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that the value of fresh food is great enough that it repays the effort to even grow it in your own flower bed.
What I found was the hardest thing for me in sort of dealing with the tapeworm was offset by living, you know, I moved to Hickory Valley, and I live in a place which is so physically beautiful. Big trees, and my cousin Billy's cow pasture is right behind my house.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about nature that just can offset. You know, there's just such a fundamental health and intelligence. And at the worst moments, I'd always walk back and just talk to the cows. And the cows would look at you like, you know, so what? And, you know, when you grow something, you know, it's so beautiful because you plant it, and then all it's kind of a little miracle. It comes out. And watching that abundance, to me, it's a it really is a philosophy of abundance. It's, you know, it's so positive return that it's kind of the opposite of the tapeworm, so it has an offsetting. So even if you live in a city and you can start to grow, you know, the Essenes have all this wonderful stuff about how to grow things indoors. And I'm out in Montana right now, and there's this wonderful farm here, Loon Lake, where they grow four seasons under hoop houses all year round, grow all their own food all year round, even in the winter. So, it can be done, but it takes you to a much healthier place.
Well, I think it takes you to a healthier place in your soul, too.
Yeah.
You know, you reminded me of what Christ says about the birds. When he tells his disciples not to worry about what they're going to eat or drink, he said, look at the birds of the air.
Right.
You know, they don't worry about that, and yet they're fed. God feeds
right.
them. And I think you were talking about looking at a cow, but the same thing is true for looking at birds or trees or, you know, just getting out into the world. You look around you and you say, you know, all of these animals are still going to be doing whatever they do, whether I win in this or not, whether I live or survive. And this whole big operation and enterprise here of the world will still be going on.
Right.
And it does bring a kind of peace to your soul. It changes your perspective so that you carry that peace with you.
Well, we're going to go to questions and answers, so now's the time to kind of close up. But I wanted to, you know, I'm famous in some circles for having these little buttons that say no whining on them. And I used to always, we had this game when I worked in the Bush administration. And in fact, every they got so popular, the Washington Post wrote up an article about my no whining buttons, and then OMB wanted them for all the other agencies, and you could tell what agencies were in real trouble by how many and who wanted no whining buttons. But my favorite no whining story is the one about Susan, so you have to tell that, because, you know, sort of one of the chief rules about how to build a lifeboat is that you can't. If you're on the lifeboat, there's no whining on the lifeboat.
No.
All time has to be spent in building and sailing away from the tapeworm and building something beautiful and learning how to do that and working together and building each other up. There's no time for, you know, one whiner can just bring the whole thing down. So.
Absolutely. Well, the Susan, when we from the day that we were arrested. Until we were acquitted, she never once complained. She sure would have been justified in saying, you know, this is all your fault, and I told you this would happen. She never said anything like that at all. She never complained. She never whined, not the first time. And I wish I could say that I came through with the same record, because
I don't have that record.
I certainly didn't. You know, there were just times that I was, as they say, lower than a fat frog in a deep well, and I didn't make any secret of it. But she never did. And you know, if I if I could say that there's one example in the world I'd like to follow, it's her example, because she never complained. And the other thing I would say is that you need to be self-conscious about what you're doing and how you're living through this ordeal. I know a great business consultant, Mac Ross, and he always says the problem with most people is that they don't work on their business, they work in their business. That is, they're so busy doing the work of the business that they never step back and say, how should we be doing this? Is there another way that we could do this that would be better? And whenever you get into a trial, whenever some crisis strikes, the first thing you need to do is just take that moment and say, how should I do this? Before you jump in there and start sorting it out.
Right. There's so many strategic points where creativity and imagination are what's going to make things work. You know, we used to call it jumping the curve, but you had to constantly step back and say, no, wait, let's look at where we really want to go. Let's look at it. You know, let's be totally creative about, you know, this is going to take 10 days, and since we only have 10 hours, what are we going to do? One of the things I found was it is absolutely imperative to be called to a purpose. In other words, the tapeworm's throwing something at you. You can't just react. You have to focus not just on dealing what you have to handle in reaction, but you have to say, okay, now where am I going? You know, what is the world that I want to create? Where do we want the lifeboat to sail to? And so the thing that, to me, everything organizes around is, you know, what's the purpose here? What is my purpose? So, and I think it's very easy to fall into the reactive trap because at times the tapeworm looks so powerful. But you have to, you know, one of the things that makes it powerful is people are not, we're not building an alternative and saying, you know, we're just not going to go along with that. So... And I remember the magical moment for me, Franklin, was in 1999. Something happened, and I realized, you know, the tapeworm's going to fail. The Titanic's going to sink. We have to build lifeboats because this thing's going to fail. Anything this evil is really just, you know, I mean, they can have all the technology and all the money and all the power in the world, but it's going to end, you know, the Tower of Babel always falls, so... This thing is going to fail, and we have got to build lifeboats.
Right, and that's what I think. What we have to realize is that's the dying system. We don't have to make any apologies to ourselves or anyone else that we want to leave that system. And the fact that I can't perfectly describe or exhaustively describe what the world that's building is going to look like is beside the point. The
right.
Old world is dying. And we have to build something else. We have to build something better to replace it. And you're right, there's not any choice because that world is blowing apart.
Right. Well, when I finally figured out a sort of a last piece of what had happened, you know, sort of who had really been making the decisions and why, I got up one morning and I started, you know, at the top of my voice shouting, thank you so much for making it clear to the world that I have nothing to do with you, and that I am totally separate from you. Because you know something? There's not enough money on the planet to get me to want to be on the Titanic, because you guys are sinking. And as you're sinking, you're not fun. You're not attractive. That's what a friend of mine says. They have no juice. Well, let's go to questions and answers. We've been joined for questions by three wonderful colleagues. One is Tom Willits, who's the head of marketing at MRW, who does the Soleri store. He's my cousin in Northampton, Massachusetts. We have Christina Engelbert, the chief operating officer of Soleri, who's coming in from Sebastopol, California. And then our wonderful prayer team leader, Eliana Obadiah from San Francisco. Tom, Christina, and Eliana, are you there?
Yep.
Great.
Yeah.
Tom, let's start with your question.
Would you like me to go?
Yeah.
I'm more than happy to ask my question. My question for the two of you is, with television, film, and print media completely supportive of a narcissistic, negative, corrupted human message, How would you suggest that we develop a supportive community with a redefined sense of success for our children? You know, they're so completely about this sort of gathering of information, and I'm really interested in how you see, starting from our very youngest, how do we change this broken paradigm that now exists?
Well, I think one thing is you have to stay away from the broken paradigm. You have to be very, very careful about about the influences on your children, not just the media influences on your children in terms of television and movies, but also the other children you bring around. And of course, the main thing that children learn from is not the words that you speak to them, but it is what they see you doing. And if your children see you leading a life of integrity, leading a life that is devoted to the truth, whatever the cost, then that's the kind of children you're going to raise, and that's the kind of community that you're going to create, because those children will grow up and they become part of a community. Another thing that's interesting is, you know, whether we realize it or not, we advertise what we are, and so the kind of people who are looking for you, who want to form that supportive community, you'll find that you run into them. And I don't think that's any accident. I think it's because of the kind of life that you live.
Right, and I think one of the big challenges for folks is, you know, we used to assume that we could move anywhere in the country and it would be safe to raise our children and to have them educated there, and that's not the case now. So I think if you have an option to choose a place, one of the most important issues is, can you create a healthy environment for your children in that place?
Well, you know, another thing is that the chief entry of the tapeworm into our lives for indoctrination is public schooling.
Right.
And if you're not willing to take your children out of public schools and to educate them yourself by homeschooling or by, you know, very specialized private school, then you might as well stop talking about all these things, because you're not serious.
Right.
If you're going to give your children to the tapeworm by putting them in public schools, you're going to destroy them. So stop talking about all this and, you know, go turn on the TV and enjoy yourself.
My cousin Jane was a teacher for 35 years in the school system in Hardeman County, mm-hmm. where I live, and, you know, she keeps me updated on all the rules, regulations, change, you know, the terrible things that are being required of the teachers. It's just frightening. And every year we have a concert. The Arts Council does a concert and plays sometimes with the kids. And the difference between the kids who've been homeschooled and in the public schools is just, it's shocking. Because, you know, we have a lot of homeschooled kids.
Right. It's astounding, because what you'll see is an 8- or 10-year-old child who can stand there flat-footed, look you in the eyes, and carry on a conversation with you as if you were 25 years old.
Right. Right. It's amazing. And it's happening even though, you know, a lot of the people, whether it's the principals or the teachers, are struggling under rules and a structure, which is pretty ugly.
You know, Catherine, public education versus homeschooling is a perfect example of where the tapeworm has literally fallen to pieces.
Right.
When in my lifetime, in the lifetime of my parenting years, back in 1970, it was just barely starting. And when people tried to homeschool, they literally faced jail time. They were put in jail. Their children were taken away from them. And they kept at it and kept at it. And now we've reached a point where even public school teachers admit that homeschooling is superior.
Yeah.
Now think.
Well,
about
it just shows you, you know, that bottom up building of a new world can work. It really can work.
Right. Well, it has worked there.
Absolutely. It absolutely has. Eliana?
My question is this: for people who have really put their attention in the so-called larger issues and not understood that local focus is what's really called for here, how does someone begin to do that? How do we even know how to move out to understand how the money and power works locally and in our state? Where can we look in the resources of our own neighborhoods and communities to get the education we need to begin to become responsible at that level?
Well, the first thing I would do is get out a copy of the Yellow Pages or your phone book and identify the key agencies of your municipal government, and then I would call them or go see them and find out what public disclosure, a lot of them have websites now, what's the standard public disclosure about who's who and what's what, you know, and so the first thing I do is I just start to learn, and then the second thing I do, because there are all sorts of public meetings and ways to get involved, is I would just start wandering around and listening. I wouldn't get involved. I think I would just get a map of who's who and what's what. And then over time, I'd identify one or two either groups of people or person who you think is really trustworthy and is doing something useful. And then I'd just see if there's something I could do that would support them. But I would think small, and I would start off small. And the first thing I just try to do is I try to figure out who's who, what's what, and who are the honest people. I call them the community wizards. Who are the wizards that I can trust? Franklin?
Well, I think you ought to be very, very careful that if you're thinking about doing anything political, that first of all, that you keep it local, because even when you get to the state level, you're dealing with more power and hidden influences, and they're huge hidden influences. That just, you know, that you can't make any headway against. Whereas locally, when you can walk into your mayor's office or the county executive's office, you can literally walk in, sit down, talk to them, and say, look, I don't like this. What are you going to do about it? You can actually have some effect there. So I think this is one of those places that I mentioned before where the tapeworm wants you to waste your time. And the way he gets you to waste your time is to engage in political activity at some level above the local.
Christina?
Well, before I came to Solari, if I heard someone say, turn to where you live and purge the tapeworm from your own family and community and build your own lifeboat, there was a time where that would have sounded like, you know, every man for himself, just fend for yourself and don't worry about anybody else. But, you know, I've come to realize through Solari that really that's absolutely the best thing you can do to help other people in the world. Because anything you do to neutralize the power of the tapeworm helps everybody. And in fact, that's what they need most from us, is to neutralize the tapeworm. You know, so I guess the question, or, you know, what can we do, what are the specific things, or maybe the top three things that we can do to really neutralize the tapeworm so that it won't clobber us or other people while we're building our lifeboats?
Franklin, do you want to go first?
Well, Christina, the place that I think most people need to start is in their own family. And what the tapeworm aims to do is to isolate us from each other and to make us little atoms out there that are not connected to each other. And one of the saddest results of that is families that are not really families, where people just really don't know each other. They don't know each other enough to love each other and to work together. And I would say the first place is, you know, to cultivate the relation that you have, the love that you have with the people who are the members of your own family. The second thing is, I think that you need to get to know your neighbors. And by neighbors, I don't mean just the people that live on either side of you, but the people in your community, so that you can form a community. And then the third thing is, all the hard questions, all the hard financial questions about how you make your own living and what you do with your money. And as Catherine said, you know, stop feeding the enemy. Stop beating the enemy. Get your money out of those nationwide banks and put them in local banks and demand that banker loan money to local people to help them in their own business.
I just have to stress that again, because what I found is that it's a bigger change than I expected for a lot of people to pull their money out of the big banks. And that's why we have an audio seminar, Where Would Jesus Bank, and other good folks too, to help folks grapple with that. But it is so important to pull any resource that we can pull from the tapeworm. It's incredible to reduce the tapeworm's power. But more importantly, there are wonderful bankers, local bankers. There are wonderful local farmers. There's all sorts of good guys. And if we can pull our resources away from the tapeworm and then put it towards the good guys. You know, Franklin, can you imagine what would happen if tomorrow 10% of the banking deposits in this country pulled out of the tapeworm 20 banks, the 20 big banks, and moved into local banks?
It'd be a huge result.
It'd be incredible. Or if 10% of us turned off our TVs and stopped subscribing to any corporate media and switched to what I call real deal media, it'd be enormous. So there's not just what we can do. We can start to educate our family, our friends, our neighbors to do the same thing. And the more the money decentralizes, the more juice there is to say, okay, now how do we build this locally? How do we build lifeboats? Because lifeboats can be a good investment for a local banker, but first the deposits have to get switched. So I'll be the investment banker in the group. We've got to vote with our money, and in any way we can think of, whether it's how we make it or how we spend it or how we invest it. Well, Franklin,
let me add something not quite that technical, but one of the ways that the tapeworm sinks your lifeboat is he makes sure that you're the only person in the lifeboat. and you know, if it's only one person, you can't bail fast enough to keep the thing on the surface. So that's why it's so important that you get to know people around you. And if you're the kind of person who talks about these things and not only talks about them but does them in your own life, what you're going to find is that you will attract people. You will get to know people. There's something about likes attracting. I don't know what it is, but you'll
right.
get to know all the people in your area who think the right way and who want to make the same changes in their own life, and you'll find that it's a lot easier if you're working together.
Well, the pro-centralization team is a team. They know each other. They have a plan. They're coordinated.
They further
each other.
And I
think what we're saying is the pro-decentralization team needs to be needs to have a plan. It can be much more organic. It can be much more decentralized. I think one of the critical issues is the one that Christina made, which is, you know, so often the people I meet who are on the pro-decentralization team think that the way to, you know, that it is moral to do things which shrink our resources. And it is imperative to realize that the more resources we can pull out of the tapeworm and shift to the pro-decentralization team, you know, that gives us more and more ability to invent our world and to shrink the tapeworm. And so by building wealth on the pro-decentralization team, we're helping the world.
You know, another thing is, Catherine, I think that we have to consciously try to build alliances across the old lines.
Yes.
The old lines are liberal conservative primarily, and primarily political, and people tend to define themselves and then refuse to associate with people on the other side of that line.
Right.
And the problem with that is the divide between liberal and conservative is utterly meaningless today.
Right.
It's completely
right.
meaningless. And so what we have to do is to look for people that we can work with on specific issues and specific things, like the local economy. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're a liberal or conservative, that you think that we ought to have local control of our own local economy so that we can work out our own economic destinies. So I'd say we need to build alliances with other people and not demand perfect agreement and perfect purity.
Right.
Because you're never going to get that in the world anyway.
Right.
And
exactly.
All that does is paint yourself in a corner, which is exactly what the tapeworm wants you to do.
Right. Divide and conquer, divide and conquer.
Right.
So what we need to do is focus on where there's unity and get something done.
Right. And where we can work together.
Right. Well, Franklin, you're just the best.
Well, you are too.
Well, I hope that our getting thrown off, you know, my prayer is that our getting thrown off the Titanic early will help other people build their lifeboats faster. Because the more lifeboats we all have, the more we can protect our lifeboats from the Titanic and build a beautiful world. And I think it will, as you said, turn out that we were blessed in what happened to us. So with that, I want to ask Eliana to lead us in our closing invocation. Eliana?
Thank you so much, Catherine and Franklin. It's always such a pleasure. And I'd just like to begin by calling all the people who are listening to settle in to a place now where all that has been said can just filter down into the place of silence inside. And to just relax into the source of all creativity and all imagination that we need to draw on in this time. And we know that, in fact, none of us are alone in the boat. And that what we have is each other. We have our families. We have those whom we choose to reach out to and make part of our inner and outer community. And I give thanks that we can focus. We can choose to focus on where there is unity and build from there. We know that our lifeboats are powered by the purposes that we're called to. And that those purposes can be worthy. That they can bless the other people in our boats and the boats that are down the river. That we're all interconnected. So with gratitude, we commit ourselves to doing whatever it takes to switch our time, our attention, our resources to that which builds up unity, that creates new possibilities, that expands our energy so that we can build a new world for our families and our neighborhoods and our communities, our towns. I just ask that our eyes be open to the way that the tapeworm is operating right in front of us, and that we can step around the trap of reaction and into positive action to build alliances across lines and to learn that together we can do anything. I just give thanks for this. A source of love that lives inside of us, a source of truth that always unerringly guides us into the right choices. And we just take up our responsibility that we have in love to keep educating one another, encouraging one another, drawing out the best in one another, and serving one another. And so with that, I wish you a good evening and all blessings. Night, everyone.